Hi, everyone. This is the March-April edition of Sports Illustrated Kids. It's their 2024 MLB preview issue with Arizona's Corbin Carroll and Zach Gallen on the front cover. They're eyeing back-to-back pennants. Let's begin with their warm-up section on page 9. Small market, no problem. When the Milwaukee Brewers traded starting pitcher Corbin Burns in February, it sounded like a sad but familiar tale, a team in a small market. In this case, the smallest media market in the league had unloaded a homegrown superstar before they could no longer afford him. This deal, however, had a twist. The team acquiring Burns, the Baltimore Orioles, usually has a lower payroll than the Brewers. In fact, the Orioles had the second lowest payroll in the league last year at around $71 million. Only the Oakland Athletics, who were one of the worst teams ever at 50 and 112, spent less on players. And they didn't even spend that much less than the O's. The Brewers, by contrast, ranked 19th in salary commitments at around $125 million. In 2020, 21, and 22, the Orioles had the lowest payroll in baseball. Baltimore, however, is in a unique situation. Despite its frugal ways, it managed to win 101 games last year on the strength of its homegrown talent, like reigning Rookie of the Year Gunnar Henderson. And the talent figures to keep coming. The Orioles have the consensus best farm system in the game, headlined by shortstop Jackson Holliday, the number one prospect in baseball. It makes sense they'd swing for a top-end starter with a lineup packed with young stars, but it wasn't just that. This offseason, a group that includes several billionaires and Orioles legend Cal Ripken Jr., began the process of buying the team from the Angelos family, who has owned the O's since 1993. These new owners won't take control of the franchise right away, but the trade with Milwaukee signaled an optimism from the front office that they will not have to part one day with Henderson and Holliday like the Brewers did with Burns. The small market, big market divide looms large in the minds of fans. Readers often email in at kip.shoremore@si.com to complain that we here at the magazine neglect writing about the little guys in favor of the Yankees and Dodgers. Some of you have told me that baseball is unfair and a salary cap should be instituted. But what does it say about market size that a couple of new owners can show up and suddenly baseball's most thrifty team instantly acts like the Yankees? Maybe it's not about the size of your city, but your luck in the owner lottery. The Orioles' status as a small market team was interesting even before these recent developments. Baltimore is just the 30th most populous city in America, but if you zoom out on the map, you'll notice Baltimore and Washington, D.C. share suburbs. The Washington-Baltimore Combined Metropolitan Statistical Area has nearly 10 million people. Until 2004, the Orioles were literally the only game in town for this huge population. Then the Montreal Expos moved to D.C. and became the Washington Nationals. The league's teams voted 28-1 to approve the relocation. Guess who the one no vote was? Now, despite having their market cut in half, despite years of futility, despite playing in baseball's historically most brutal division, the Orioles, of all teams, are poised to break out as MLB's next major power. Granted, they haven't spent that much money yet. Baltimore ranked 22nd in payroll going into spring training this year, but in an uncapped league, a new owner can make all the difference. 10 years ago, the 22nd-ranked payroll was, believe it or not, the New York Mets. Last year, they set records spending well over $300 million on players. I kind of look at that like you're looking at the wrong person. Mets owner Steve Cohen told ESPN when asked about other owners' annoyance with his spending, "They're putting it on me. Maybe they need to look more at themselves." He's got a point. Forbes estimates that the average MLB team is worth $2.32 billion. Anyone who owns a baseball team would seem to have the coin to afford good players, or the financial incentive to sell to someone who does. At that price level, teams aren't so much business as trophies for people for whom money is no object. So stop complaining to me if your favorite team is cheap. I've got $24 in my piggy bank, for which I've got big plans. One Godzilla X Con, the new Empire, IMAX ticket, and a large popcorn. Instead, you should be emailing every mega-rich person who even kind of likes baseball about how nice Pittsburgh is in the summer. Next up in the warm-up section, future star Tana Fernandez. Born in Bowie, Maryland on May 28, 2009, her sport is wrestling. When she dyed her hair red last year, Tana Fernandez wanted a physical reminder of the fire within her. It motivated her to push herself in the gym even when she didn't want to. Dominance on the mat followed. The Archbishop Spalding freshman won the girls' 132-pound title at the top high school preseason tournament, the Super 32. She then took gold at the U15 Pan American Championships and has beaten collegiate wrestlers this season. "I don't want to rest on my laurels," says Tana. "I know it's just the beginning for me." Next up, Kip answers your letters. Roshan writes, "Hey Kip, I was just wondering your opinion on the whole Milwaukee Bucks head coach drama. They fired Adrian Griffin because he was inconsistent when it came to pressure, but wasn't Doc Rivers fired for the same reason? He does seem like a more experienced coach, but as Giannis stated, the Bucks are hungry for a championship in the next two seasons. So why hire someone who has a bad playoff record?" "And the coaching carousel keeps turning," responds Kip. "The Bucks turning to Rivers seems like an especially ridiculous example of the phenomenon of teams opting for safer, sure-thing coaches, especially ones who have never won a title. I get that they didn't want to replace one first-year coach, Adrian Griffin, with another one mid-season. But if you need a coach mid-season and he's got to be experienced, you're probably going to end up with someone who's been fired from a lot of previous jobs. Hey, Andy Reid struggled to win the big game for decades before the Chiefs dynasty began. Am I seriously comparing Doc Rivers to Andy Reid? No. I'm desperate for a positive spin here." Next letter. Max writes, "My question is about awards. We all know that in MLB there is an NL and an AL MVP, but in the NFL and the NBA there is one MVP throughout the league. My question is, why not two MVP awards? What do you think? Should they change it up?" "Actually, Max," responds Kip, "I'd be inclined to go the other way. I think that Major League Baseball needs to consider switching to a single MVP. The dual awards for the two leagues in baseball reflect the fact that the American League and the National League used to be genuinely separate organizations that would only meet to test their best teams against each other in the World Series. Now interleague play is a daily occurrence. Granted, many players have their bonuses tied up in winning awards, so maybe they could add MLB MVP and MLB Cy Young honors, in addition to the league awards." Next up, Kid Reporter. This is by Rusty Smith. Marchand talks leadership. Earlier this season, Boston Bruins captain Brad Marchand sat down for an interview with SI Kids Kid Reporter Rusty Smith. In his first campaign wearing the C for Boston, Marchand talked about what it takes to guide one of the NHL's best teams, which captains he most respects around the league, and how to be a young leader. Question from SI Kids, "Why do you think you were chosen to be the captain of the Bruins?" Marchand responds, "I think I was chosen to be a captain for the Bruins because we have a very unique culture around here. We have had some incredible leaders in the past, and there are very high expectations. I take a lot of pride in what it takes to be a Bruin. I think we also could have had multiple guys that could have been a captain this year. I'm very, very excited and fortunate to be named captain." Next question, "Were you a leader as a kid?" From Marchand, I was a leader at times. There were times when I think I could have been a better leader. I learned how to be a leader really the last 10 years because I've had incredible leaders around me, and I really wanted to learn from them. I became a much better leader as I got older. Next question, who's your favorite leader outside of the Bruins? His response, Sid Crosby is a great leader. I played with him a short time, and I've known him for a long time now. He's an incredible leader. You hear a lot of stories about him, just about how incredible a leader he is. Jonathan Toews was probably the most prepared leader at a young age that I've seen. He came in as a captain very young in his career, but I've played with him before that. I was very impressed with how great of a leader he was. Next question, what advice do you have for kids who want to be a leader? His response, some things that I wish I would have understood a little bit better when I was young are that it is very easy to get caught up in being shy or being nervous or trying to be cool within groups of people. Always be cautious and conscientious about doing the right thing. It doesn't matter if you're with a group of kids that are doing the wrong thing or being mean or making fun of someone. Good leaders always stand up for what's right. They always take care of everyone. So I think a big thing is to make sure that you are always doing the right thing, helping people out regardless of if your friends think it's cool or not. You always want to be there to stand up for people that can't stand up for themselves. Next up from this edition of SI Kids, it's Juju. We called it. Former Sports Kid of the Year, Juju Watkins is revitalizing USC. Cheryl Miller did something last summer that she had never done before. She bought USC women's basketball season tickets. Miller is the best player in the history of the program, if not the history of the game. She led the Trojans to glory, two NCAA titles in the 1980s, served as head coach in the 1990s. Yet she couldn't remember when she'd last caught a USC game before this season. After all, the Trojans had gone more than 15 years without an NCAA tournament win. But that reality began to shift over the past few years when former Cal head coach Lindsey Gottlieb was hired by USC to lead the program in 2021. She extended an open invitation to former players, welcoming them back to campus. As the season drew nearer, however, she realized she wanted more. Miller was going to come back to Trojans games, she decided, not just occasionally, but as often as possible, as close as she could get. For the first time in her life, Miller bought USC season tickets, and she prepared to bear witness. She needed to be front and center for this. Cheryl Miller wanted to watch Juju Watkins. The 6'2 freshman guard had been the top recruit in the country, boasting a rare combination of skill, size, and speed. She could have played at any school in the country, but the Los Angeles native decided she wanted to restore a program in her hometown. Watkins grew up near the USC campus in the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles. She learned to play hoops at a park there named for her great-grandfather. A civil rights activist, Ted Watkins, founded the Watts Labor Community Action Committee, which aims to ease poverty and improve quality of life in the neighborhood. He spent decades working to provide affordable housing, jobs, and health care in the area where those were often scarce. Ted died before Juju was born, but his legacy has always felt very near to her. In 2020, when a 15-year-old Watkins was named SI Kids Sports Kid of the Year, she chose the park as the location for the photo shoot. Ted Watkins' motto was, "Don't move, improve." That principle resonated with his great-granddaughter. It was much bigger than basketball, but it framed her college choice in a way that felt right to her. "If I'd stayed home," Watkins said, "I'd have the chance to build something bigger that meant more than if I went anywhere else. Don't move, improve." Watkins took those words to heart and chose USC. She began delivering on the hype immediately. She scored 32 points in her college debut, a statement win over number 7 Ohio State. This kind of performance from her soon felt routine. USC's record for 30-point games in a freshman season had been 3. Watkins passed that in November. In February, she did something no USC women's player, not even Miller, had when she passed the 50-point mark, dropping 51 on the road in a win over number 4 Stanford. At one point in the third quarter, she was outscoring the Cardinal 40-39. Watkins has done in a few months something no one else had been able to do in her lifetime. She'd return USC women's basketball to national relevance. Her teammates called it the Juju Effect. Sold-out gyms, autograph seekers, an entirely different environment from a year ago. Home attendance has tripled year over year. Celebrities show up at games. Throngs of picture takers surround the team bus. That's the kind of stuff I saw when I was in the NBA, says Gottlieb, who was an assistant for the Cleveland Cavaliers. Miller was taking it all in from her courtside seats. Beyond her historic playing career, she coached in both college and the WNBA, in addition to spending years as a broadcast analyst. What comparison does she have for a freshman this dominant, a two-way player so early in her career? There is one other person who really stands out, Miller says finally, and that would be me. All right, let's get on to the 2024 preview of the MLB. Leaning in, fresh off a World Series appearance, the Diamondbacks are embracing their role as the good young team no one is talking about. Back in December, the Yankees pulled off a huge trade, nabbing Juan Soto from the Padres, giving the sport's most iconic franchise one of its best young hitters. 5 days later, the Dodgers blew that news out of the water by signing two-way phenom Shohei Ohtani to a 10-year contract, giving the team that won 100 games last year the best player on the planet. To say that those two stories have dominated the offseason baseball discussion is an understatement. When Ohtani ultimately revealed the name of his dog, Decoy, in December, it was front-page news. So that means no one is talking about the teams that actually, you know, went to the World Series last year, the Rangers and the Diamondbacks. And that's fine with Arizona pitcher Zach Gallen. It's hard to get to the World Series and even harder to win the World Series, which is what we found out, he says. So, to not garner the respect and put a sour taste in your mouth, but I'm always a person that's looking for a chip on my shoulder anywhere I can find it, so in that sense, I kind of like it. Gallen, like many of his teammates, came up big in the postseason, winning his starts in the wild card and the NLDS rounds, and then throwing 6 no-hit innings in Game 5 of the World Series. But the team almost didn't make it that far. Arizona, which lost 110 games in two years ago, stormed out of the gate in 2023. By mid-June, the Diamondbacks had a 4-game lead in the NL West and were on pace to win 101 games. Then they came back to earth. 2 months later, they were under 500. They snuck into the playoffs as a wild card by a razor-thin margin, despite losing their last 4 games of the season. After 2 innings of their first postseason game, a wild card matchup with the Brewers, they trailed 3-0. Gallen likens it to getting punched in the mouth. Enter Corbin Carroll. The 23-year-old rookie outfielder had spent all season giving the club a jolt of energy. He hit for power, 25 homers. He hit for average, .285. He made a difference on the base paths, 54 stolen bases, 10 triples. Against Milwaukee, he stepped up with a man on in the top of the third, crushed a Corbin Burns pitch 444 feet, cutting the lead to 1. Second baseman Ketel Marte hit the next pitch over the fence, and the Diamondbacks never looked back. You could just see that sense of relief, says Gallen. It was like, we belong here. We can play. We can do some damage. Carroll humbly agrees it was a turning point. Being down 3-0, they've got their guy on the mound. I don't think that's necessarily like a super inspiring moment to be in, he says. But as a group, we felt confident we could compete against anyone. and I think that confidence definitely grew over the course of the postseason. It didn't come as a surprise that Carroll was at the heart of Arizona's success. In many ways, he and 28-year-old Gallen are emblematic of the team. They're young, loose, fun, and really, really good. "It's a very chill vibe in here," says Gallen of the Diamondbacks clubhouse. "We have different little groups that will do our own thing. We have the guys that play games. We have the guys that like to golf. We've got guys that just like to go out to dinner. But none of those groups are, like, exclusive. I'm not really a big gamer, but I can still hang out with those guys. It's a vibe that's conducive to building a solid young team." Last year, Arizona had veteran third baseman Evan Longoria as a steadying presence. This year, the D-backs signed 31-year-old outfielder Jock Peterson, who has 2 World Series rings. This is a cool dynamic in our clubhouse, where we've got so many guys learning the ropes and trying to establish ourselves as big leaguers, said Carroll. "And to be able to bounce ideas and support each other, kind of in similar situations, is unique and something that goes back to our time together in the minor leagues." After beating the Brewers in 2 games, Arizona swept the Dodgers and came back from 2-0 down to beat the Phillies in the NLCS. The D-backs' run ended against the Rangers as they lost the World Series in 5 games. "We feel like we still have something left to prove, that last year wasn't a fluke," says Gallen, who has finished in the top 5 of the NL Cy Young voting each of the past 2 seasons. In the offseason, Gallen got a new puppy, an English bulldog named Moose, who is not receiving nearly as much attention as Decoy, despite the fact that he is, by all accounts, a very good boy. If that doesn't put a chip on Gallen's shoulder, nothing will. All right, so now let's go around the league and highlight a few of the teams. In the AL East, Baltimore Orioles. Baltimore is about to get a new ownership group, and they don't seem shy about shelling out money. Bringing in starter Corbin Burns is a huge move, but the O's can't count on big bucks to bail them out of trouble. Fortunately, Baltimore is a young, hungry team led by the reigning Rookie of the Year infielder Gunnar Henderson. As long as these kids remember what allowed them to win 101 games last year, before a disappointing ALDS exit, 2 years removed from a 110-loss campaign, they'll be a very tough team to topple. Tampa Bay Rays. If the expression, "the more something changes, the more it stays the same," applies to one major league team, it's the Rays. Due to limited resources, Tampa's front office is constantly tinkering with the roster, such as picking up Yandy Diaz, who went on to become the 2023 AL batting champ, from Cleveland in a trade no one paid attention to at the time. This offseason, the Rays sent ace Tyler Glasnow to the Dodgers in a deal that returned promising starter Ryan Pepiot. Many teams don't like to shake things up, but Tampa has shown that continuity doesn't matter much. New York Yankees. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, the Yankees won world championships with brute force, picking up seemingly every big-name player on the market. Then that got fiscally impossible to sustain, and they started building more conventional teams, but not winning. Well, things could be changing. In December 2022, they re-signed Aaron Judge to a massive extension. And this offseason, they traded for Juan Soto, giving them an unmatched 1-2 punch. If ace Gerrit Cole gets any help in the pitching core, New York just might be able to follow the old formula to get back to the playoffs after an 82-win season. The Toronto Blue Jays found themselves as surprise players in the Shohei Ohtani sweepstakes over the winter. But since Ohtani chose the Dodgers, the Blue Jays' biggest move turned out to be re-signing outfielder Kevin Kiermaier. Unless it turns out Kiermaier can pitch, Toronto is going to be facing a decline, and time is of the essence to get things sorted out. The club's young core, anchored by Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette, is fast approaching free agency, meaning the team's window in a very tough division is closing fast. Boston Red Sox. Since winning the World Series in 2018, the Red Sox have missed the playoffs in four or five seasons. Last year's 78-84 mark was largely attributable to the pitching staff. No starter had an ERA under 4, while Brayan Bello and Cutter Crawford showed promise. The team needs a number one starter. The Sox signed free agent Lucas Giolito. He was an all-star in 2019. He also had a 4.88 ERA last year with three teams. If Boston has any hope of reversing its slide, it needs a top-of-the-rotation arm to match up with the other aces in the division, and Giolito likely has to be that arm. Now in the AL Central, the Minnesota Twins, last year in the AL Central, featured two teams that lost more than 100 games and two others that finished at least 8 games under 500. Someone has to win the division, and unless their home state miraculously shifts to a coast, sending them to a new division, it will probably be the Twins. Minnesota made the playoffs last year thanks in part to a solid pitching staff, one that lost two of its top starters in free agency this winter. The Twins tied for the AL lead in homers, and they will slug even more if Byron Buxton, 17 home runs in 85 games, can stay healthy. In this division, that should be enough for a postseason return. Next up in the AL Central, Cleveland Guardians. Last year's Cleveland's outfielders hit 18 home runs, a total equaled or eclipsed by 123 individual players. The Poplar's Guardians hit for a decent average, possess a lot of team speed, and play very good defense, epitomized by left fielder Stephen Kwan. So if baseball were to return to the dead ball era, Cleveland would be a real threat. Alas, flannel uniforms, limp baseballs, and oversized bats aren't making a return. So the Guardians will have to hope that they can win with solid pitching and an offense that will have to rely on singles and stolen bases. Detroit Tigers. Teams commonly try to lock up their young talent to long-term deals. The player gets a guaranteed paycheck while the team doesn't have to worry about his salary skyrocketing in arbitration. And that's why Detroit locked up 22-year-old second baseman Colt Keith for 6 years, even though he hasn't spent a day in the majors. It's a good move if he contributes at all. Keith could bat first in a lineup that also includes 24-year-old slugger Spencer Torkelson and several other kids who give the Tigers hope for the future and an outside shot at competing this year. Well, let's move to the AL West now. Texas Rangers, World Series champs, were a feel-good story last year as opposed to, say, the Mets, who were a study in dysfunction. Ace Max Scherzer witnessed both joining the Rangers at the trade deadline from New York. As long as Scherzer doesn't think he's back in the Big Apple and bring the Mets' bad vibes to the Lone Star State, the Rangers should be tough to topple. Even though Scherzer will miss the beginning of the season with a back injury, Texas can count on a full season from late-season call-up Evan Carter, who joins the AL's most imposing lineup. Pitching is the issue, but the team added a few veteran bullpen arms. In the NL East, the Atlanta Braves pitching staffs throughout baseball learned one thing last year. You can't stop the Braves from hitting home runs. They tied the MLB record with 307, led by Matt Olson's 54 and Ronald Acuna, who hit 41, while also stealing 73 bases. The only thing that would slow the offense down would be MLB instituting a rule mandating 30-foot fences. Even then, Atlanta's pitching is good enough to carry the club, especially with the offseason addition of 7-time All-Star Chris Sale. The Braves come into the season on a mission. They won 104 games last year and then got bounced in the NLDS, where the Phillies out homered them 11-3. In the NL Central, Cincinnati Reds. Few teams rely on heat more than the Reds. Hunter Greene's fastball averaged 98.3 miles an hour last year. He routinely topped 100. And then there's shortstop Ellie De La Cruz, who can not only throw fast, he had a 97.9 mile per hour assist. He can run swiftly as well. He stole 35 bases in 98 games, including second, third, and home in the same inning. So long as MLB doesn't institute a speed limit, Cincinnati will continue to be one of baseball's most exciting teams. And with a balanced lineup that will benefit from the addition of free agent Jamer Candelario, the Reds could translate that energy into a first division title in 12 years. In the NL West, the LA Dodgers, when they signed Shohei Ohtani to a 10-year, $700 million contract, the Dodgers weren't just getting the best baseball player on the planet, they were getting the most popular one as well. With a stacked lineup that is now even more stacked and a pitching staff that welcomes righty Tyler Glasnow from the Rays, the biggest challenge in L.A. will be to not get crushed by the hype machine that comes with Ohtani. Cameras follow his every move, fans clamor for him. The Dodgers won 100 games last year, should be substantially better, but it's never easy playing when all eyes and lenses are on you. Well, that's going to be where we're going to have to stop today. For the 2024 MLB preview from Sports Illustrated Kids, this is their March-April 2024 edition. Thank you for listening. Hope you have a great day.